Well, good morning and welcome. I'm Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and welcome. And I'm calling this first meeting of the 21-22 legislative session to to order. I want to just remind everyone this meeting is being held pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for remote hearings of this type of thing. We found that there are certainly some disadvantages to having these virtual hearings, but there's some advantages as well in terms of folks being able to participate and attend who may not be able to. I want to remind everyone who's on this this Zoom call that's being broadcast to stay muted when you're not speaking. Use the raise hand feature if you wish to be called upon. You should be able to find that in your Zoom application. And let us know if you have any concerns. And a reminder to members and to members of the public that meeting materials are posted on our committee website. You can find that at the House website. There are a number of documents related to this meeting. They've also been emailed to members and staff as well. And so I'm going to provide just a few introductory remarks, and then we're going to do a roll call for members who are on. And then we'll get going with the content of the presentations today and with the agenda. So just as a background for this committee in early childhood, we're addressing issues relating to the earliest weeks and months and years of life. It's from birth up through preschool. This is a committee that through its work is connected with work on other committees in the legislature relating to health and human services and education, K-12. We really have a focus on early care and early development, and of course, early learning as well. And I'm pleased to let members know, members of the public know as well, that this term, this committee will be what's called a major budget committee. And so at the level of overseeing the accounts and the budget items related to those pieces. So our focus today is going to be on early care and development of learning during the pandemic. And we want to be sure that we have plenty of time for that. And so for that reason, what I'm planning to do is to have to save introductions of committee members and staff, extensive introductions, until Thursday. This committee meets every Tuesday and Thursday from 8:30 to 10. And so we're going to save that. What I'm going to do is just recognize our staff members who are on, and then we'll do the roll call of members and then move on again with the content of this of today. Regarding staff, we have our nonpartisan staff is Annie Mock from Nonpartisan House Research, who's supporting us, and Ms. Mock is waving. And we've got Doug Berg from House Fiscal Staff on the HHS side, Health and Human Services side, as well as Emily Adrians from Education, the Education side of House Fiscal Staff. And then supporting our caucuses are Maris Beltrani-Rudquist, supporting the DFL caucus, and Judy Withers supporting the GOP caucus and GOP research. So we have just a terrific staff. And then for supporting the committee are Polly Cirkvenik, our committee administrator, and then Shanika Chambers, who's the committee legislative assistant. And again, on Thursday, I'd like to have each of those folks that are members as well say hello and describe a bit of their backgrounds. But I ended with Ms. Chambers because I'm now going to call on her to please take the role of the members.
Hello. All right. So Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden. Representative Bolden. Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative DeMuth?
Present.
Representative Juergens?
Present.
Representative Cotiza-Watoon?
Here.
Representative Morrison?
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott?
Present.
And Ms. Chambers, I want to note for the record that Representative Bolden is on. She was having trouble getting her audio to work. I think we're going to continue to work on that.
This is Representative Wadswick. My name also wasn't called. Just want to point out.
Thank you, Representative Wasilick. Yeah, so Ms. Chambers will make sure that we have that as well. And so I want to note the attendance of both Representative Wasilick and also hopefully without objection, the attendance of Representative Bolden as well. We'll work on that audio issue. So good. And so with that, we do have a quorum. And so then moving on with our presentations. And so again, the focus today, members, is on early care and learning during the pandemic. This past term, we had several hearings regarding this, the committee, a number of members who are currently on the committee this term, last term as well. And as we know, early care and learning was in crisis even before the pandemic. And we've had the situation become even worse since. As I said, I really wanted to make sure that we started this term diving right into the situation to understand what's going on right now, to understand the status during the pandemic, the state, the status of state and federal responses to the concerns, and then looking at a number of options going forward. I want to point out, members, that there is a bill, House File 5, that was introduced to provide emergency support. It's likely that we'll hear some version of that in the coming sessions, coming hearings. But I want to make sure that we really understood exactly what's happening right now. And so we are going to hear from four presenters. They're on the agenda that you have to talk about different aspects. And we're going to start off with Suzanne Pearl with First Children's Finance. And so I'm going to call her to please describe what's happening with this on the ground. And so Ms. Pearl, if you could first introduce yourself, identify yourself for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Suzanne Pearl. I'm the Minnesota Director for First Children's Finance. Thank you.
And Ms. Pearl, if you could explain what First Children's Finance is for folks, and perhaps you'll be doing that in the course of your testimony.
That is part of my remarks. I'll start with that. Thank you. Good morning. Thank you, Representative Pinto and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. For those of you who are unfamiliar with First Children's Finance, we are a Minnesota-based nonprofit celebrating our 30th year of working to increase the supply and financial sustainability of excellent child care. We are a community development financial institution, the only CDFI in the country whose entire lending portfolio is made up of childcare businesses. In addition to lending, we also provide business consulting and technical assistance services to family childcare providers and childcare centers, as well as working with rural communities looking to address their childcare needs. And our focus on the business side of childcare has never been more relevant than it has over the course of the pandemic. I've been asked here today to provide the view from the ground regarding how childcare businesses are faring now nearly a year into this. But I think it's worth taking a moment, as Representative Pinto referred, to revisit where things stood pre-pandemic. As you may recall, the word widely used to describe childcare then was crisis. Families struggled to find childcare or afford childcare. Childcare businesses struggled to stay in business. And childcare staff worked for long hours and low wages, entrusted with the care and development of our littlest Minnesotans. So why a crisis? The financial aspects of childcare have always been complicated. There is a delicate balance between financial viability, accessibility, and quality. Unlike most businesses, the market for childcare cannot sustain the cost of delivering childcare. For example, for childcare centers, labor, often at low wages as mentioned, is normally 70% of their fixed costs, with another 20% for facilities, leaving little for anything else, including program and curriculum, much less profit. Family providers face similarly slim margins. On average in Minnesota, after expenses, family providers report revenue that equates to less than $25,000 a year salary. Given the long hours required of family providers, 49% of providers make less than $8 an hour before taxes. In greater Minnesota, that average is closer to $6.50 an hour. We are also experiencing a significant demographic shift in the sector, with many providers retiring, but without younger providers entering the business. These factors have contributed to a significant gap in the availability of childcare across Minnesota. So that's where we were pre-pandemic, crisis. where are we now? In mid-March of last year, my colleagues and I started pulling licensing data from the DHS licensing lookup website every week in order to track licensed childcare capacity for both family programs and childcare centers over the course of the pandemic. Our data shows that there has not been a significant loss in licensed childcare capacity. While there has been a decrease across the state in licensed childcare programs, the rate of decrease, around 5%, is not significantly different from previous years. However, this data is limited in what it tells us, as it measures only licensed programs and capacity and doesn't show the many variables and upsets of the past year, including temporary program shutdowns, perhaps due to COVID exposure, or longer-term shutdowns that may yet lead to loss of license. It doesn't show programs that stayed open but had to reduce enrollment capacity due to staffing shortages. And we know that many childcare businesses have had to close on short notice, leaving families scrambling to find appropriate care for their kids. Conversely, childcare providers had to juggle decreased enrollment as families pulled their kids out of childcare, while those businesses also face increased expenses related to cleaning supplies, PPE, and increased staff time and resources to comply with public health guidance. This uncertain situation put even more financial pressure on small businesses that, under the most favorable circumstances, still for the most part show very small profit margins. But there is some good news here, and that is that the overall sector hasn't completely collapsed, which was a legitimate concern last spring. When childcare providers were asked to step up to stay open to ensure essential workers on the front lines of the pandemic were able to access childcare, they did so. And in turn, the state of Minnesota also stepped up. The peacetime emergency grants, followed by the public health support funds, provided a critical infusion of capital, better enabling childcare businesses experiencing severe downturns in revenue to ride out the ebbs and flows due to unstable enrollment levels. Additionally, many childcare businesses were able to take advantage of EIDL and PPP programs, though the administration of these programs also served to highlight existing racial inequities in our financial systems. We heard from many childcare providers of color who either did not have the right kind of banking accounts or the right banking relationships in order to access these programs, and thus were once again left behind. While direct financial support helped fill critical gaps in capital, at the same time, organizations like mine have seen a significant increase in interest from providers in business-related training and services. We quickly produced a develop-approved training on crisis management during COVID and increased our training offerings on other financial management topics. Since the pandemic began, we have provided web-based training to nearly 500 providers across the state. Just last night, our training on business plan development had more than 60 registered participants. These providers probably didn't get into childcare businesses because they loved reviewing financial statements, but this past year has shown how important it is for them to be fluent in all aspects of their business, and they're doing what they can to stay afloat. As you know, of course, the public health support funds ended last month. Many providers are anxious now, having passed what has been referred to as the December cliff, and are concerned about what may happen over the coming months without further financial support. I share their concern and would like to note, with respect, that it would be a shame to come this far to the point where we can see a small yet very real light at the end of the tunnel, only to let the childcare sector fall down now, just as many businesses are getting ready to open back up and will need their employees available in order to do so. As we look forward to and hope for a robust economic recovery, there are a couple of areas of concern I'd like to highlight. First, while the adverse effects of the pandemic have been felt by all types of childcare programs, we are particularly concerned about the position of childcare centers, and particularly those in Greater Minnesota. Childcare centers have more and higher fixed costs than family childcare programs, and right now many are struggling to keep up with those fixed costs. Many have lost staff who fear COVID exposure and thus are not able to maximize their enrollment and return their revenue to meet those fixed costs. And centers operating in rural areas often aren't as able to attract staff and or families as in larger markets. Second, as I mentioned earlier, the pandemic has highlighted systemic racial inequities, and one of those is the gap in linguistically and culturally relevant childcare. We have heard from parents from communities of color who have told our staff that they want to be able to factor representation in the childcare that they choose. But at the same time, aspiring childcare providers of color continue to face barriers to business ownership and access to capital. Finally, as we think about what the childcare sector might look like post-pandemic, let's not be satisfied with just going back to the crisis level where we were before. When I spoke in front of this committee last April, I said that if there's any positive from all of this, it's an overdue, wider recognition of the critical role that childcare plays in our society and our economy. And that is even truer now. I also wondered last April whether we should consider working parents as solely comprising the market for childcare and thus bearing the sole responsibility for the cost of that care. I said then that no, the market for childcare is not just working families. It's businesses who need to hire employees from those working families who need childcare. It's communities who need strong businesses, who need employees, who need childcare. And finally, it's the entire state of Minnesota. Our state needs the childcare sector to survive the remainder of this pandemic to be ready for an economic recovery that we hope is not too far off. I ask you to keep this in mind as you consider options to continue to support the childcare industry so it can continue to support the rest of us. Thank you for your time. I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Pearl. And so and members will be pivoting in just a second to hear from several folks in the state agencies to talk about some of the responses to what Ms. Pearl described. If you have questions for Ms. Pearl, please indicate with the raise hand feature. I'm going to just ask a couple things in noting in particular that this is our first meeting, so we have some folks who are new to this issue. And so one thing that I do want to note, Ms. Pearl referenced some state and federal funding and grants and supports that have been provided. I think we're going to be hearing about them in just a minute from the folks from the state agencies. As Ms. Pearl noted, that funding ended at the end of December, and that's the cliff that she referenced. But a couple just sort of basic points. One thing, Ms. Pearl, can you please just lay out for folks who are brand new to this issue, since this is the first hearing, about family childcare versus childcare centers and how folks might just sort of understand what those things are, what kind of role those played, especially you referenced childcare centers in Greater Minnesota. Sort of what are we talking about? What does that look like for somebody who's brand new to this sector?
Sure. And as somebody who was brand new to this sector a year ago, I'm well-versed in how to explain this. Family childcare is largely what you might consider when you think about somebody caring for kids in their own home. Doesn't always have to be in their own home, but by and large, that's generally it. The license capacity can be 10 or 12 children. So these are smaller programs within the home. There are about 7,200 licensed family child care programs in the state of Minnesota. Centers can be either for-profit or nonprofit. Size depends on their market, and I actually don't know what the top licensing limit is for childcare centers. If somebody else does, great. But this would be what you would, looking more like a business, maybe with different ages, with infants, toddlers, preschool, and school-age children. Is that sufficient?
Thank you, Ms. Pearl. Yeah, that's helpful. And when you reference then that childcare centers in Greater Minnesota being a particular concern, yeah. Are we talking about sort of one big building in the center of town, or what's the impact in terms of describing that?
Well, the impact right now is that we hear from centers who, so let's say they have licensed capacity for 75 kids. And So they hire staff, and those staff, they have to have a certain number of staff for a certain number of kids to meet licensing ratios. And they've got, they've got different rooms for different age groups. With the pandemic, you know, a lot of people have been pulling their kids out of care. They want to keep them at home. Or if they've got their school age kids home doing remote learning, they're going to choose to keep their younger kids with them. So the child care center has lost revenue for that enrollment for those younger kids who have been part of their center. Some centers are reporting that they can't find staff. Child care center, this is low wage work. It's important work, but a lot of staff are, you know, worried about the virus. So they're just, you know, going to sit out for a while, and it may not be worth their while. Or maybe they have their own kids who are home from school and they need to be with them. So in rural areas, you know, there might be one center for a region that draws from, you know, families across a greater geographic area. And that center was, you know, counting on what that market is. And once they start losing either the enrolled kids or the staff to serve those enrolled kids, they don't have as diverse of a market base to draw on. So that's one of the reasons that revenue is really a concern for us with rural child care centers.
Okay, thank you. I know Representative Pryor had a question. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Pearl, for the presentation this morning and the information as background to get us up to speed and moving forward. And I want to follow up a little bit again on what Chair Pinto has been talking about, which is, as we have defined it, this December cliff that we fell off of. And I know you said that, you know, you're checking and people are looking at it and wondering about it, but I guess what I'm trying to say is, when will we know? And what kind of, I mean, it seems like at this week, it's when we should be aware of it and be ready for action to put into place so that we don't have closures that are then permanent. So how are we watching this, and what kind of information should we be looking for to make sure that we're not missing what's going on? Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you, Representative Pryor. As I call on Ms. Pearl, I just want to note again for folks who may be brand new to this, again, I think we're going to get more of this in the next upcoming presentations, but there had been essentially monthly support being provided to providers in our state right from really, I think, starting in April, running until the end of December. And so that's what Representative Pryor is referencing, is that then that support ended December 31. So Ms. Pearl, if you can respond to the question.
Sure. And thank you for the question, Representative Pryor. One very clear thing that we're watching is payroll. Many of the child care centers around the state have been counting on the financial supports to help them meet one of their fixed costs, and payroll is coming up here now pretty quickly in January. We'll also look at facilities payments, rent and mortgage payments, whether or not they're able to make those. We've heard from, you know, as I said, we are a CDFI, so we are also a lending institution. We've had inquiries from people who have had to try to take out new bank loans to maintain their facility payments. People are putting up a lot of collateral and are in danger of losing some of their personal assets. So I think we're going to see pretty quickly, at least where centers are concerned, a real difficulty for those that have been relying on the monthly financial supports.
Is it prior? Anything further? Any other questions from members? Looking for that. And Ms. Pearl, are you able to stick around for a while with us?
I am.
Okay, that's great. Okay, I don't see any other questions right now, and so I'm going to thank you so much, Ms. Pearl. And so, calling up Aaron Bailey, Assistant Commissioner with the MMB and Executive Director of the Children's Cabinet. And so, Commissioner, if you can identify yourself, and then please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erin Bailey, and I have the privilege of serving as Executive Director of the Governor's Children's Cabinet. The Children's Cabinet is housed within Minnesota Management and Budget, and it's an interagency partnership that the governor has charged with helping make Minnesota the best place for each and every child to grow up. In COVID response, I have also co-led, along with the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Education, a COVID response work group called Education and Childcare. I'm here today to provide an overview and an update on the COVID-19 childcare response strategies and information on data and the status of childcare in the state. But first, I want to thank legislators, including those on the committee, two of which serve on the Children's Cabinet Advisory Council, and the stakeholders and providers who have supported the state's childcare providers and families needing care during this challenging time. The Education and Childcare Work Group was formed in March by the governor as a cross-agency action team dedicated to supporting emergency access to childcare, education of Minnesota's children, and other supports. This model was modeled off national emergency operations and similar to how other states have structured their response. The group is charged with coordinating the administration's cross-agency emergency response related to education and childcare, working towards the goals of supporting our educational system, distance learning, and care in schools for children of critical workers, creating supports for the childcare infrastructure, maintaining care opportunities for workers in critical sectors, and beyond as the economy begins to reopen, and to ensure families and employees understand available childcare and school-age care. Our agency participation in the work group includes the governor's office and six agencies, including education, employment, and economic development, health, human services, labor and industry, and management and budget. As I share some reflections and data today on the state of childcare and next steps of how we work together, I want to again say thank you. The governor said in a speech a few weeks ago, when all of this is said and done and the stories of this 100-year pandemic are written, there will be heroic stories written about childcare providers who did everything they could to make sure that the first responders, make sure that the frontline workers, and make sure that many of us have a place of safety, well-being, and growth in the middle of a pandemic. As the mother of a three-year-old, I cannot echo how much we feel the sentiment of this. Since the start of the pandemic, childcare providers have stepped up to remain operating and serving children. Their heroic sacrifice by childcare businesses and their staff has meant the stability for our youngest Minnesotans, the economic stability for our families, and all of us having the workforce we need in terms of our ability to have an emergency response and over the longer term in economic recovery. We know that our hospitals and healthcare systems have told us that about one-third of their staff depend on childcare access. We believe that we've persevered through this pandemic as a result of their heroism, partnership, and frankly, their open dialogue with us throughout the pandemic. The administration is incredibly grateful for their sacrifice and the commitment to children and families and our state. Throughout the pandemic, the work group has engaged childcare providers, legislators, and stakeholders to determine how best to support the industry and workforce. There was no playbook for what we were entering. The governor and lieutenant governor, through the COVID response and the work group, prioritized supporting childcare providers in their emergency response, knowing this critical role that they play in ensuring that essential workers have the ability to report to work. I will talk about federal and state funding for childcare providers during the pandemic shortly, but I want to just provide a brief recap of the overall work group strategies and efforts, because many of these have been important and are critical partnerships with providers. The work group created a central hub for cross-agency communication, responsiveness, provider partnership, with the goal of clear communication, warm handoffs, feedback loops, and responsiveness. We created a response website to share information. This website is still up. It's mn.gov/childcare. It provides one site with all public information, including tailored COVID guidance for children, youth, and school programs. You might remember at the beginning of the pandemic, our state quickly developed public health guidance to help support childcare providers in staying open. This was before the feds had created any guidance or the CDC had put out their childcare guidance. As the CDC then provided guidance, we made clear to point to one source of truth for providers and adapted. But as you can imagine, while trying to keep your business afloat, all of this is quite confusing if there isn't sort of a one central place to know where and what you need to be following. We created regular communication to and with providers, and I would emphasize with providers. This has included public health calls, varied in frequency based on need and what providers have wanted, regular update emails with cross-agency content, everything from new public health information and financial resources to new federal business requirements that apply to them. We created specific outreach and support to hotspots. For example, some of our Latinx programs have seen outbreaks at multiple times during this pandemic in a disproportionate way, and the partnerships across agencies and in the private sector allowed us to engage and adapt messaging and supports. We developed a financial supports matrix to outline all of the financial supports and how they may relate to center programs, and a separate matrix specifically for family childcare programs, answering questions about PPP loans, eligibility, unemployment, et cetera, and tried to build partnerships with federal agencies as well, so webinars with the U.S. Small Business Administration and others to help providers understand the very specific requirements that apply to them. And then we've developed strategies around financial support, supplies, and other components that I'll talk about, including public-private sector relationships and how critical those have been. Central to the goal of the work group was connecting families who need care to open providers, including and beyond school-age care for essential workers. Our goal was to utilize the existing industry for emergency care needs rather than be in a situation where providers were closed and need to create a brand new care system that could undermine an already vulnerable industry trying to survive. There's a map for families on mn.gov/childcare, and we have created specific outreach and response to employers, workers, responded to hospital asks and priorities to ensure that those care needs are met. The work group built a family resource guide for Minnesotans with information from across state systems, including childcare, mental health responses, and other tools to help families navigate the resources that might be they might be thinking about as they think about their child and family at the center. Likely implied in the work group description, but central to our work is the coordination of policy and procedural changes for schools and childcare, ensuring partnership and engagement on public health guidance aligning for families, prioritization and testing, and other related strategies. This also ties into a commitment for cross-agency communication, including, as I said, warm handoffs and supports around finances, testing, and critical care supplies. I want to speak specifically to supplies. We hear a lot about the need for funding supports, but we also know that supply needs and supports have been a difference maker for many and were a huge priority at certain points in this pandemic. Some of us may remember, and many legislators on this committee have helped to call grocers or stores at times when the difference between staying open and not was the ability to be able to purchase milk or hand sanitizer. To date, 57% of childcare centers and 38% of family childcare providers have received supplies from the state, which includes masks, gloves, hand sanitizer, bleach, et cetera. We developed a subgroup focused on supply supports for providers. And a huge thanks to Think Small, who worked with us on the distribution of those donated and procured supplies. These partners work together to have a process for responding to community outbreaks to ensure that providers and communities in these communities might have had a special touch and support. Earlier in the pandemic, the state also called upon local emergency operation centers to help support that need at a local county level. The private sector also stepped up and communities came together. Partners like Cub Foods, we worked closely with, created a unique food and supply ordering and purchasing process so that providers who typically aren't big enough for their own supply chain or can't be at a store at 6 a.m. due to care obligations had a process to order and get those supplies. Several legislators engaged actively, as I said, in helping work with local stores, and I personally want to thank you for this. The governor also included executive order language to prevent supply limitations for care providers, and we engaged with grocers, stores to explain the language and help support from both ends. We also built partnerships and accepted and shared with partners for distribution donated products. Companies like Due Nord, Factory Motor Parts that donated thousands of gallons of hand sanitizer and bleach. Thank you. I'd also just mention that testing prioritization has been an important priority that we've heard from providers. And attempted to respond to. Childcare has been included in a priority in the MDH guidance since really the beginning of the pandemic. A test code was provided for a free at-home ordering saliva test kit to all staff working in childcare settings by the state. This was prior to the state launching a at-home ordering process. And we have recently launched a screening testing program based on a pilot that we conducted with providers and Head Start programs late last year and with feedback from the community. I should just say this program is entirely optional to programs that signed up. Digging into the financial support specifically, Minnesota has leveraged federal and state resources to support the childcare industry and families needing care, like the increased school-age care access for lower-income families and administrative flexibilities to support providers and care access. The financial support providers have received from these resources include $30 million in legislative allocation, and then an additional $10 million from the CARES Act Child Care and Development Block Grant Funds for the peacetime emergency grants. This was a competitive process focused on critical sector access during the stay-at-home. More than 3,100 programs received funding during one or more rounds of this grant. The COVID-19 public health support funds occurred from July to December and were funded through the federal coronavirus relief funds. There were two proposals passed by the Legislative Advisory Committee, funds that provided both from two periods from July to September, $56.6 million, and October to December from $53.3 million. The program supported 8,364 eligible licensed centers, licensed family childcare, and certified centers that received a payment in one or more of those months. 7,044 programs received payments July to September, and then 8,364, as I said, between October and December. The breakdown of those is about 6,300 licensed family childcare providers, about 1,500 licensed childcare centers, about 500 certified centers. Financial supports provided were per month and based on the available research and community feedback, including, again, from legislators, and I thank you for that partnership. It included licensed family child care providers receiving 1,200, licensed centers receiving 8,500, nonprofit and certified centers receiving 8,500 in July and August, nonprofit and government certified centers receiving 3,000 in October and November. In December, licensed providers received a reduced amount due to funding limitations and high demand. And again, I want to emphasize the success of this program has depended on open lines of communication and feedback loop with legislative leaders, providers, and available state and federal resource. I also want to mention that early childhood and wraparound supports for young families was central to the workgroup's response led out of MVE and GEAR dollars, which I believe MVE will touch on. In the bucket of huge gratitude for the private sector, I also would like to mention that the Minnesota Initiative Foundation's Think Small and other external partners stepped up immediately in March and helped raise and commit dollars to support childcare providers early in the pandemic response. While a critical sector for our emergency response, the industry faces significant ongoing increased costs given the requirements needed to safely operate childcare in the midst of a pandemic. These are not able to be met without support. Childcare businesses operated on slim margins before the pandemic. Costs, challenges with cost and revenue have only increased for providers. And you've heard some about this already today. And I would also defer to providers themselves, but I'll share a high level of what we hear in our engagement and research. Creating smaller, more consistent childcare groups leads to higher costs in staffing costs and program adjustments. We hear about screening procedures and increased cleaning, additional staff and personnel time, as well as program modifications. Temporary program or classroom closures due to cases or exposures, and I'm going to talk a bit about those in a second, including closures that could lead to continued pay of current staff while also hiring substitute teachers. Over 2,000 of our programs have now had a case since the pandemic began. And adaptations to classroom spaces and facilities, including outdoor areas and distance learning supports. There are a few research efforts that we've utilized to help us understand the gravity of these costs. A Federal Reserve Bank report estimated that the public health guidance of smaller group sizes alone, not to mention supplies or other costs, can cost a family child care provider about $1,200 per month and a center up to $18,000 per month. Center for American Progress analysis used a state-by-state calculator finds that providers are facing an average of 47% increase in operating costs during the pandemic associated with personnel costs and increased sanitation. That's nationally. The report shows it's higher in Minnesota, 66% higher costs for family child care and 60% in Minnesota for centers. Next, I'll touch quickly on key characteristics and challenges of the business and workforce. As I do this, I want to commend my partners at DHS, licensing and childcare services who have honestly moved mountains to support providers informed by this data, especially licensors who our work group has relied on as frontline leaders, understanding, engaging, and responding to the field. Childcare industry is made up of small business. Majority of our providers are family childcare. And the majority of Minnesota centers are single centers, not chains. Workforce is primarily women. Many of them are women of color and earn low wages. The median wage, Suzanne touched on this earlier, is $12.28 per hour. Continued increase to implement public health guidance that increased staffing, critical care supplies, quarantine periods, which I shared earlier, temporary program and classroom closures, and then staffing challenges and shortages causing ongoing business operations and individual stress and strain. The provider stressors and challenges are documented by the National Association of Education of Young Children in pandemic provider surveys. Key findings on this are on, if we can go to the next slide, are listed on this slide, and I won't read through them in detail, but I just highlight by saying that nearly half of the programs say they're staying open is currently causing them to lose money, even with supports in place. As we talk about stressors and challenges, I want to share a brief epi curve of the COVID-related exposures in childcare. This is from the MDH weekly report from July 7th. It's provided weekly, an update of this is provided weekly on MDH's website. It highlights that roughly 63% of the potential exposures in childcare are staff, 37% are children. Again, I'd emphasize these are potential exposures of folks attending while they were likely infectious. It does not necessarily mean that transmission occurred in the program. Our work group also tracks the data over 28 days. So this data here is cumulative, which can help us better understand what's actually circulating in programs and be able to help support where transmission may be occurring. In our report from MDH last week, over the last 28 days, or what we say is two incubation periods, 73% of childcare programs that have had a case have had only one case. 5% have had five or more cases. These numbers have been more or less consistent throughout the pandemic, and a testament to the focus childcare providers have had on mitigating transmission and following public health guidance. Now I'll share some data available on the current status of childcare in Minnesota, starting with the operating status of licensed programs. The percentage of family childcare and childcare licenses operating dropped at the beginning of the pandemic, but have returned to nearly 100%. This capacity is needed as programs are running at smaller group sizes and have other changes, and this committee has addressed for many years what we know to be true in terms of a shortage of childcare long before the pandemic. The visual shows estimates of operating status by licensed family childcare in blue and licensed centers in green. The first plate on the slide is pre-pandemic where providers were, and of course, all operating. The second point is from an operating survey of providers done by DHS licensing that found that 89% of family childcare providers and 58% of centers operating in April. The next two points are data from the public health support applications where you can see that in July and October, 90% or more of our license capacity was operating. Next, I'll share data from DHS licensing on trends in license opening and closures in 2019 compared to 2020. I'll go through these graphs really quickly, but in summary, this is what you'll see in the data. Both openings and closings have slowed for family childcare and center licenses during the pandemic compared to similar months in 2019. A net decrease of family childcare has been lower in the first 11 months of 2020 compared to the first of 2019. 2020 showed a net loss of 281 providers compared to 2019, which showed a net loss of 379 providers. No impact is demonstrated on the proportion of family childcare license opened and closed in the metro versus greater Minnesota. Licensed center providers have seen almost a similar net change from 2020 versus 2019. 2020 showed a net gain of 28 providers. 2019 showed a net gain of 27 providers. Overall, the Minnesota childcare industry has fared better than many states in the number of programs operating, but it continues to be a vulnerable industry rocked by the pandemic. Now I'll go through these charts with an overview of 2019 versus 2020 trends from centers and closures versus openings, and then family childcare closures versus openings. This graph shows childcare licenses closed for calendar years 2019 and 2020. 2020 is in green and 2019 in blue. The next graph shows childcare licenses opened for calendar years 2019 and 2020. Again, the net gain for 2020 is one more licensed childcare center than in 2019. The next graph shows family childcare licenses closed for calendar years 2019 and 2020. In nearly all months during the pandemic, you will see that more licenses were closed in 2019 compared to 2020. This next graph shows family childcare licenses opened for calendar years 2019 and 2020. In nearly all months during the pandemic, you will see that family childcare licenses were opened in 20, more family childcare licenses were opened in 2019. The net decrease of family childcare has been lower in the first 11 months of 2020 compared to the first 11 months of 2019. And no demonstrated impact on the year-over-year trend that we see and worry about related to the decrease in family childcare providers. The graph showing percentages of closed childcare facilities by state, this image shows percentages of closed childcare facilities by state. It's a report from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Inspector General, based on responses to a questionnaire and interviews as of date April 30th, 2020. The report stated that state agencies reported that about 63% of childcare centers, 27% of family childcare providers have closed during the COVID-19 pandemic. 8 states reported that more than 75% of their facilities had closed. 20 other states reported that between 50 and 75% of their facilities have closed. In total, we consider this data to show that our strategies have worked, and again, would commend the heroes that have stepped up to help stabilize a critical industry during an unprecedented time. And hopefully we'll continue and enable our state to have a stronger economic recovery. And most importantly, this has provided consistency and care for our Minnesota kids and families. We continue to leverage research and data available as well as engagement with all of you looking towards the work in 2021 and beyond. Current activities and challenges include engagement in short-term and longer-term strategies for new federal funding, vaccine prioritization and implementation, continued ongoing engagement with providers, navigating needs and questions, financial supports and resources, including quickly analyzing, continuing to receive feedback, ongoing understanding of supply needs, and related to testing, routine and regular access to testing for providers, the launch of the on-site testing program that I mentioned, which currently has 140 programs enrolled and Head Start participating statewide, the at-home saliva test ordering program for smaller programs and our family childcare programs, and then the continued need to match emergency workers with care options as they respond to the pandemic. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Commissioner. That was terrific information to pull together. Thank you so much. And thank you in particular for your point towards the beginning about the heroic work done by providers throughout this work. And you and your team have just worked enormously hard. So I thank you so much. Members, if you have questions or comments, please indicate as you may do that. I actually wanted to go back to a couple slides, if you can bring your presentation back up. And again, members, I'll keep an eye out. Maybe before we do that, in fact, I'll call on Representative Wazlebeck and then I'll ask my pieces. So Representative Wazlebeck, so let's go back to the committee, my apologies. And then Representative Wazlebeck calling on you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, that's one of the slides was looking at states across the country and the closures that had happened. I don't know, Commissioner Bailey, if you know, were those permanent closures as of September 2020?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, those, I believe the data in the report I mentioned is from the end of April, but those are what the report tracks as permanent closures.
Was look anything else? No. Okay. I'll keep an eye out for other questions. But in the meantime, yeah, if we can bring the presentation back up, then my apologies for the back and forth. And I wanted to go to the slide that showed the survey of providers. If we can, it was maybe about 2/3 of the way through. I'm thinking. Hopefully, you know the one I'm talking about. It said 48% said that they have been losing money. Was the one that I had in mind to look at. Thanks. I just wanted to sort of dive into this for a second. I know you had to move quickly, Commissioner, but this felt worth it to me. since these are from our providers in Minnesota. And I guess the one that jumped out the most to me was this first point about nearly half losing money in the course of this, and recognizing the margins were extraordinarily slim before then. I guess I just wanted to be able to take a look. I mean, can you, and I guess I want to confirm, Commissioner, if you can, that this is, of course, even with the monthly supports that had been provided from April to December. Is that right? Is there anything more you can describe about kind of what's, I guess I'm finding these numbers pretty striking, but anything more that you can comment about kind of what the current challenges are for providers?
Yeah, Chair Pinto, thank you for the question. So we track as many reports as are out there and information that we can get our hands on. I would say that this data very closely follows what we hear and see from providers and the community. I think I touched on this briefly, but you know, the data tells us that about 70% of the budget, and Suzanne could certainly touch on this as well, is related to personnel costs. Mm-hmm. And so when so much of the guidance is around smaller cohorts, screening, social distancing, and then closures and need for additional substitutes, that we're seeing those pretty dramatic costs, and then in addition supplies and other components. So I think, yes, this survey was conducted in context of when supports were happening. So it was a recent survey in November. So we would have known that our supports were happening. And I did touch on just earlier the Federal Reserve kind of estimate in terms of what particular costs. And so we know that our version of the public health supports for most programs is not meeting their incurred losses or additional costs. It's helping to provide some basic support, and I think in some cases some hope and stability to be able to ride out some more difficult times. But we haven't seen that longer term public health support strategy as completely mitigating losses or costs in any way.
And then speaking of those supports, if you can go back to the slide that describes the state and federal supports, I think it's maybe 7 or 8 back from this one. Here we go. Yeah, thank you. And I mostly just want to be sure. Can you just again, for folks who are brand new to this, the first and second bullets there. That first bullet was state funding, and I think we were the very first state in the country, which probably helps to explain why we've had fewer closures. But can you just sort of again for we have a number of committee members who are brand new to this. Break down that first bullet was the state funding. It was competitive, smaller number, and then that second bullet was federal. Can you just sort of walk it through for somebody who's brand new?
Definitely. And we think about these pieces sort of in phases. So this first bucket, and again, a huge gratitude to the legislature for stepping up so early on. I think this funding was absolutely critical. These were larger dollar amount grants. So again, they were focused on I should say, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. We're focused on trying to meet that essential worker access, the sort of tier one critical sector worker during the stay at home. So at a period when many businesses were closed, how do we ensure that emergency workers have access to care? And we knew at that point that enrollment in programs was down 70 to 80%. This is when many providers faced kind of a really huge cliff, and we're trying to decide what to do. So these were larger grants that were provided, again, not to everyone, but to providers really sort of zoned in on those areas where we knew we had high critical sector worker need and access, and funded, again, through state. And then based on sort of the need and what we were seeing and feedback loops with all of you and with providers, the state advanced $10 million of CARES Act. So those were sort of, that was flexible child care money that needed to be spent on child care but could have been dedicated to a variety of purposes, moved an additional $10 million into that $30 million state appropriation in those last rounds. So those were 3 months of grants. And then the second phase is this public health supports phase, which started in July. So the peacetime emergency grants ran the first 3 months of the pandemic. And then since July, we've been operating under this public health support structure, which are much smaller grant amounts. As I said, $8,500, generally $8,500 for centers, $1,200 for licensed family child care providers. And those supports were really kind of based on direct public health costs that we could estimate. And those are monthly and not competitive. So anybody eligible, and I would say we've gotten a lot of feedback from providers who, some who might have businesses in multiple states. I talked to one provider who has a business in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and they have a program. It's a little different than ours, but more administrative components. Really, this program was sort of, it was a flat amount you applied. I would say that DHS, again, kind of move mountains to make that application process as smooth as possible and provide some stability in those awards over time. And those payments have been funded out of the coronavirus relief funds and went through the LAC process. So those are flexible dollars that we could have spent on sort of a variety of COVID response related in the state, testing or other pieces, and that the governor administration prioritized specifically for childcare. It's about $109 million thus far.
Thank you, Commissioner. And so again, for folks who are brand new to this, I just want to be sure we're clear that top bullet then is $30 million in state funding, $10 million federal funding, and it ran from April through June. We all in the legislature authorized that in March. And then from July to December is this purely federal funding that again expired December 31. And so now we're in the spot of having had those monthly payments and they've now stopped. Am I saying all that correctly, Commissioner? Just want to make sure I'm accurate in that. Looks like, yes, I'm seeing something nodding there.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if it's, if I can follow up then with a slide on that you had of all the states and how we rank in terms of the number of closures that we've had. So, yep, that's it. That's that. Thank you. So this is, Minnesota's good. I mean, nobody's happy, but at least we're on the right end of this and we're in the positive part of this comparing states. And, you know, when we put the information together, is there reason to conclude it's the choices that Minnesota made to give the early grants, then also to structure a program and to prioritize keeping the childcare infrastructure up and running? Can we conclude, or is there reason to think that that is why we have done well compared to other states because of those choices that we made?
Commissioner Bailey.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pryor, I would say a resounding yes, coupled with the partnership and real heroism and hard work on behalf of the providers. I think we hear from states often with questions of how we've responded. I talked to a colleague state yesterday who's in a much different position than we are in. And I think, and I say that based on feedback we hear from providers that sort of continuity in the structure of that, is of the supports and the partnerships that have been built from Child Care Aware to many others that I mentioned today have been critical to that. And I would say, again, we think about this as like a collective. We legislators have stepped up in huge ways. Providers have stepped up in huge ways. And there was no clear playbook here. And, I would say that continues to be true. So when we talk about the engagement in terms of the next phase and what needs to happen, we really want deep partnerships to understand how to continue to respond and be in this position. And I think the last thing I would say is I personally feel really obviously share concerns that were shared early on in this hearing about the vulnerability and making sure that we continue to move in this trajectory. But I would also say that I hope that this puts us in a position where Minnesota's economy can more quickly recover as well, and that this the structure and strategy here was really strategic to be able to support the state in larger ways as well.
President Pryor, anything further? Be a little tough to tell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to say thank you for the. And again, just to reiterate, and it cannot be said enough, our providers, and then everybody else that has been a part of this effort, including the legislators that that took those votes and supported our childcare industry when it really mattered. But then also to end with that caution, which is we are still going through this period of transition. And so to bring this back up to a front burner of awareness of a need that we have right now. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And I'm not seeing other questions. And so, Commissioner, I thank you very much for your testimony. And again, to your team for your really, really hard work. Really appreciate it. Thank you. And hopefully you can stick around a little bit in case there's any other questions. I'm actually inclined to switch to have Ms. Hewitt from Department of Education present next, and then end with Director Yang. And so if we can have Debbie Hewitt from Early Learning Services, MBE, and if you can identify yourself for the record and then please present to us now.
This is Debbie Hewitt, the Interim Director of Early Learning Services at the Minnesota Department of Education. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to talk with you this morning. I was asked to describe how school-based early learning or pre-K programs were addressing the needs of our youngest learners during the pandemic. I was asked to share the number of districts currently in person, some of the guidelines that we're operating under, challenges that were faced or methods used to implement the guidelines, and describe how distance learning works at this age. If there's time, I'd also like to think about the needs still to be addressed and opportunities that came about because of COVID. So I'll be focusing on school-based early learning or pre-K programs, and those include school readiness and early childhood family education, voluntary pre-K and school readiness plus, and early childhood special education. Also in the Division of Early Learning Services, we are responsible for state funding for Head Start and Early Head Start, and the health and developmental screening program, as well as early learning scholarships. Those will be focused on in another opportunity. So early learning programs sit at a unique intersection. Because we're part of the school system, we vertically align to the pre-K-12, so our guidance has been aligned as much as possible to the standards and protocols for school. But we also are horizontally aligned with the age band, so at times it's important for us to follow the health and safety standards of the age group. There are several challenges that have resulted from COVID for these young learners. COVID came at a time and distance learning, at a time in a child's development when we want to engage them in creative play, exploration, physical activity, social interactions, and so on, rather than have them sit in front of a screen. So to shift to distance learning has been challenging, and we have tried to remain focused on playful and varied learning opportunities. This fall, we've seen families choose not to send their child to pre-K and K, resulting in some under-enrollment in programs. And this has an impact on children as they miss out on the social interactions. It has an impact on families as they struggle to balance work, school, and family responsibilities. So in early learning, we're really focusing on incorporating learning through the daily routines that families typically engage in. It has an impact on staff as people come back to the public schools and enroll their six-year-old, potentially in kindergarten. And so we're looking at bigger differences or varieties in ability of children within a class, and how are we going to support staff as they work with those varied abilities. And then schools impacted when funding is dependent on fees or reimbursements for a particular service. So we've been looking at what flexibilities do we have where reimbursements maybe need to be based on averages of past years rather than the current numbers of children. As some of the early learning offerings were reduced, it made meeting the needs of children with disabilities and their families more challenging to have inclusive settings available to them. So we've worked to open additional classrooms and address some of the underlying fears when children with disabilities have medical conditions and allow home visiting to take place and one-on-one activities whenever possible. Staffing challenges have been felt dramatically with a lack of substitute teachers, staff reductions, and in some cases reassignments, and that could make it difficult to deliver the program in some districts. We utilized some AmeriCorps volunteers and looked at who else might have the qualifications and the abilities to support our youngest learners. Based on the Safe Learning Model dashboard and the lookup tools that were posted yesterday, we know that 130 districts were engaged in distance learning, 51 in hybrid, and 177 were operating in person instruction. And this could change on January 18th as additional early learning and elementary are welcome back to in-person learning. So what are the guidelines and how likely are districts to implement those guidelines? Early childhood goes back to in-person as one of the age bands or grade bands. And that we know that staffing shortages might make it hard for all classes to go back in person within a district at one time, and some may remain in distance learning even for a bit longer, but it'll be phased in and we'll welcome students back into the classrooms as soon as possible. Early childhood programs are part of testing and part of the counts for testing and PPE. Children are to wear face masks when engaging in indoor physical activities is one of the newer recommendations for mitigation. And this will be a behavior or a routine that needs to be taught like any other. Early childhood is included in the recommendation for their staff and teachers to wear a face mask and a shield. And this can be challenging when you know that children are learning so much from the facial expressions of the people around them. And yet my three-year-old granddaughter will say, I can see her. She's smiling in her eyes. So she knows her teacher is smiling. One of the mitigation strategies is to maintain groups of 10 or less and the maximum group size of 20. The idea of a cohort model isn't foreign to early learning. Expected ratios are 10 to 1 with a group size of 20. And developmentally, it makes sense for programs to be in small groups with one adult to a small number of children to help establish strong relationships. Meals in the classroom is being suggested if they can't maintain the physical distancing and the separation of cohorts in the cafeteria. This age band often eats meals in their classroom. It helps children focus, staff eats with them, and they can teach multiple skills during snack and meal times. A great transition activity at the end of the school year is to be able to eat in the cafeteria and teach children those routines. So if that's possible this year, that'll be a great help in transitioning. For students with disabilities, home visit guidance continues to be at the district level decision based on MDH guidance for providing services in the home. and we prioritize families and students that have struggled virtually or are unable to come into a district building for one reason or another. The timelines and requirements for IEPs and IFSPs remain in place. So what does district learning look like for preschoolers in practice? Our recommendation—
And Ms. Hewitt, I'll probably let you know, I think we've got just a couple minutes left for you here.
Okay, so, thank you. Thanks. Our recommendations from the beginning have been to focus on routines. Learning and curriculum can take many forms, where teacher and child or small groups of children are engaged in synchronous or asynchronous. Watch a recording of a story or of a lesson so that can be done at a parent or a family's convenience, as oftentimes the schedules of the older siblings that are in school takes priority. Many districts have decided to provide materials in activity boxes that are delivered to the home, and then lessons are delivered around what's in the activity box. And there's often one-on-one calls and activities with the child. At this age, learning is reliant on a learning partner. And in families, that learning partner can be a parent, a grandparent, a sibling. But this age typically needs help to log in on a virtual device. They choose from a list of activities and then verify which have been completed. And they often offer open office hours where families can sign up for conversation and activity when it's convenient for them. So some things that still need to be addressed. We need to look at and support those who did not enroll in kindergarten, even though their child was age eligible, and help build those relationships as they come back to the schools or enter schools next year. We want to help offer some opportunities through summer programming so that children can gain some experience prior to kindergarten. There's always variability of skills within a classroom, but it could be greater variability. So how do we support teachers in looking back and looking forward in learning progressions through greater alignment of curriculum instruction and assessment in pre-K and third grade? And then all children experienced COVID as a traumatic experience, but to different degrees. And so teachers will need support as they help children who are doing the best they can to cope, but maybe acting out in different ways. We want them to be able to promote safety and emotional well-being for each child. And then for some children who really experienced COVID as a significant trauma, we will need additional mental health supports. Mr. Chair, that will conclude my remarks for today. Thank you.
Ms. Hu, thank you so much for your remarks and for your work. And to confirm, members, I wanted to have us get a look at early care and learning from multiple perspectives in this hearing. Any questions from Ms. Hewitt? And I'll give just a minute here to be sure that I'm not missing anybody about what's happening in our districts. I will say the thought of some incredible work being done by our in-person early care and learning providers, and then I just can't even imagine the work of working with preschoolers at a distance. But in some cases, that's what's needed at this time. Okay, not seeing any questions from anybody, and if you do, perhaps Ms. Hewitt will be around for a little bit for us. And so then I'm going to call on Cindy. Oh, pardon me. Yeah. Who is that?
This is Representative Katiza Witun.
Katiza Witun. I'm so sorry.
Put my hand up. That's
all right. Yeah. Representative Katiza Witun.
Thank you. And I'm hopeful so that you could just maybe expand, Ms. Hewitt, on some of the best practices for the, you know, the preschool age group, as far as, you know, different creative ways to keep them in proper spacing. I know, my daughter is in a half-day 4-year-old kindergarten program, and they've been able to be in person almost the whole school year thus far. But, you know, some of the, like the airplane arms is something that I had read from one of the other countries that had gone back to school earlier on in the pandemic in the springtime. And I'm curious if you would be able to share some of those in practice, best practice things that the department has maybe shared with our in-person preschool programs.
Yes,
Ms. Hewitt.
Thank you for the question. Our teachers are incredibly creative in how they're helping children learn about this, and bumps, the hula hoop that helps define the space, a carpet square that you sit on and is spaced appropriately, conversations about the importance of wearing a mask in public spaces, washing your hands, and the social distancing have all become part of the curriculum now to teach these new routines and safety mitigation.
Representative Katisa Witun, any follow-up?
No, thank you. I think it has been really fascinating to see some of the things that she's brought home. She's very big on air hugs. And so I know that they're, you know, doing a lot of just still being able to share some of those important moments that, you know, they're have been used to being able to do in person with their teachers and their friends. And it just, you know, it's so different. But I think that the teachers, our educators, are doing such a wonderful job kind of making age based appropriate alterations to the daily schedule. And so I appreciate you kind of sharing that a little bit, because it's fun to see. And obviously, you know, we all hope that sooner rather than later, we'll be able to return to some of the normal quote unquote practices of years past. But I continue to be so impressed by the commitment and the creativity of our educators here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Katisa Witun. And again, thank you, Ms. Hewitt. I do want to move to Ms. Yang to get to her important information to share. So Director Yang, if you can identify yourself for the record, then please begin your presentation.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Cindy Yang, Director of Child Care Services Division at the Department of Human Services. Thank you for inviting me to testify today on the new federal COVID-19 relief funds for childcare. So for the overview of the new federal COVID-19 relief bill, funds for the coronavirus relief were included in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021, which was signed into law by the President on December 27th, 2020. The bill included $10 billion for childcare, made available to states through the Child Care Development Fund, which is administered through my division. We have not yet received an award letter. However, we expect for Minnesota to receive an estimated $137 million in additional funds. Some key dates that I do want to highlight here: by approximately February 25th of 2021, which is 60 days from enactment of the bill, we must submit a report to the U.S. Office of Child Care describing how DHS intends to use these funds. By September 30th of 2022, DHS will be required to have obligated the funds. By October 31st of 2022, DHS must submit a report to the Office of Child Care describing how the funds appropriated in this act are committed to be spent. And then also by September 30th of 2023 is when all of the funds must be spent by. In regards to requirements and eligible providers under this bill, any provider currently eligible for the CCDF funds would be eligible for funds under this law. The law does.
Ms. Yang, can I stop you just for a second? Can you, for folks who are brand new, can you just say what CCDF funds, what that means?
Sorry, CCDF is Child Care Development Fund, and so that's the federal funding source that DHS receives in order to support the child care services system in Minnesota.
And Ms. Yang, it funds our child care assistance program, among other sources of funding for child care in our state. Is that correct?
Correct. Okay. That also provides supports to our subsidy program, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thanks so much. Please continue.
The law does provide flexible funding with a few requirements. It waives minimum quality and infant toddler set aside that's generally required for the Child Care Development Fund, although it maintains the administrative funding cap. The new funds must be used for purposes related to COVID-19 response and can also be used for expenses incurred prior to the enactment of this new law. It requires the availability of funds to be publicized widely and that technical assistance be provided to help providers apply for the funds. As for the potential options for uses, which is noted in the federal language, the bill provides several options for uses, including the following that I'll mention here. Those related to the Child Care Assistance Program, again, which is the subsidy program for us here in Minnesota. It allows costs of providing relief for co-payments and tuition payments for families. It also allows child care providers costs or that is usually paid through family co-payments to provide continued payments and assistance to child care providers in the case of decreased enrollment or closures related to the pandemic. Enrollment and eligibility policies that support the fixed costs of providing child care services by delinking provider reimbursement rates from an eligible child's absence and a provider's closure due to COVID-19. And then also child care assistance to healthcare sector employees, emergency responders, sanitation workers, farm workers, and other workers deemed essential during the response to the pandemic by public officials without regard to the income eligibility requirements of CC, the Child Care Development Fund. There are other, also other options for the states to consider, which includes help providers to remain open or reopen as appropriate and applicable. Also support the stability of the childcare sector to help providers afford increased operating expenses, including through stability payments as we provided in the COVID-19 public health support funds for childcare program, which you heard earlier. Also encourage providers to use funds to continue to pay the salaries and wages of staff, and then publicize, publicize available funds and provide technical assistance to help providers applying for the funds. And so in coordination with the Children's Cabinet and then also drawing on feedback from many legislators and stakeholders in the recent months, DHS has put in place a couple of short-term plans for how to use a portion of the funds in the first months of 2021 here. These plans are consistent with the following shared values to ensure that we prioritize access for low-income families, support childcare industry as an essential emergency sector needed for COVID response and economic recovery, and then also steward resources that build towards a stronger and more equitable system in the long term. And so the short-term plans include these eligible uses of funding as allowed in the federal law. We are looking to reduce or temporarily fund CCAP basic sliding fee wait lists using our existing statutory authority and infusing $15 million to serve up to 780 new families, balancing the funds over two calendar years, so calendar year 21 and also calendar year 22. For calendar year 21, we're anticipating to put in $10 million, and then for calendar year 22, we're anticipating on putting in $5 million. And so counties and tribes will have revised calendar year 21 allocations posted soon. This supports essential workers.
And Ms. Yang, I just want to ask you if you could wrap, I think this is your last slide, if you can wrap up pretty quickly so I can make sure in case there are questions and we can be done by 10.
Mr. Chair, I will make sure to do so here. This is estimated that 82% of families eligible for CCAP works in the critical sector. We are for the second short-term option here that we're anticipating on doing is also continue the successful COVID-19 public health support funds for childcare programs for the months of January and February. This is an estimated cost of $45 million. And so DHS must move quickly to use the new federal COVID relief funds to continue these payments, requirements to operate at lower ratios and group sizes with substantially lower profit margins continue to put the industry at risk. And so the payments DHS has made so far from July to December have stabilized the childcare market. And so in addition to these short-term uses, DHS, in collaboration with the Children's Cabinet, we intend to rapidly identify longer-term strategies for the use of the remaining funds in terms of the public health supports for childcare providers. And so we look forward to conferring with all of you, members of the legislature, as well as other stakeholders in the coming weeks.
Ms. Yang, just leaving this up for... Thank you so much. And just leaving this up for a second, reasonable best case scenario, looking at the second bullet, because I noticed your schedule earlier in your presentation, what's the reasonable best case time frame for when providers would, when those payments would resume, the ones that ended in December 31, recognizing it could take a while. We don't even have, it sounds like, the federal letter yet. So can you just give a sense as to what the timing might be?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I think reasonably, we because we don't have the federal funds in, haven't received the actual award notice just yet, we are in conversations about if there are alternative funding sources that we can identify to continue implementing the public health support funds. And so I think at minimum, it will be at least another 2 weeks for us to be able to get the to revamp the public health support funds specifically. As for the childcare, the basic sliding fee, we are looking to move on that much sooner than I think what we are able to with the public health support funds.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Yang. We've got just a couple minutes left. Members, hopefully you've been knowing to raise your hand if you have questions or otherwise. I'd like you to please do that. And I thank you, Ms. Yang, both for the presentation and for your just really hard work over the last number of months. And this is important to have that understanding. And I'm just looking to see if folks have their hands raised or otherwise. Representative Wasilla will call on you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Yang, for the presentation. I'm wondering, I noted in your the slides that the sort of estimated allocation of funds would be around $137 million. So I'm wondering if you could talk about if there's ideas for, at least from me doing the math in my head, that didn't add up to what the short-term goals are. So I don't know if DHS or others have talked about what else that funding might be used for going forward.
Ms. Yang, if you can give us a brief sense of that. Get you unmuted. There you go. Ms. Yang.
Mr. Chair, my audio was breaking up a little bit. Representative, like, I think you're asking the total amount and not having received the award notice yet. We have not received the award notice, the purchase. $100 million is from a national report that has been made public.
Ms. Yang, I think you're breaking up for us a little bit. I'll ask Representative Wasilewicz to ask her, because I think it's a little bit different than what you were starting to answer. Representative Wasilewicz, if you can just ask your question again, hopefully Ms. Yang
can hear you. Sure, I can try again. I'm just, I know that number, that $137 million, is not a for sure right now, but if there were more funding than what DHS has already talked about doing in the short term, if there are ideas for what to do with that additional funding above the $45 million and the $15 million that you've already talked about.
Ms. May, if you can give us a sense of those longer term, the possible longer term plans, if you can hear us.
And Chair, I can jump in.
Commissioner, why don't we have you answer, Commissioner, if you can. I think we're having trouble with Ms. Yang.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Wasilewicz, it's a great question. So I think, again, what we're focused on here is immediate response and stability, and then quickly, simultaneously working on engagement with providers, all of you and others, on what the I would say longer term immediate needs are and how we respond. As we talked about earlier today, there's, you know, $110 million from CRF funds were spent in that July just to December, I think, based on where we are in COVID. Our focus has been to try to move quickly in terms of the bridge to a vaccine and where we are in terms of predictions from a public health sector and in surge in cases, and then to really immediately and, like I said, simultaneously be working together in partnership to develop those medium to longer term strategies in terms of dollars. And we heard really loud and clear in the engagement at the end of last year around some ideas around that and what partnership and offboarding and sustainability would look like, and want to make sure that we're engaging that in the process and next steps before we would make those determinations.
Thank you, Commissioner. We are at time, but I really want to encourage members to feel free to reach out to the agencies, be in touch with. I'm happy to connect with you as well. This is obviously a really critical issue right now, and it's good that this federal funding is coming, and now we need to figure out exactly what the plans are. Thank you, members, so much for our first hearing. We'll look forward to seeing you. Members of the public, please join us at 8:30 on Thursday. Thank you again to all of our presenters for your work. And with that, our meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.